You're listening to Parentwise from Squamish Waldorf School. I'm Kirsten Andrews. We're speaking with Astrid Lackner, an early childhood educator of more than 30 years and mother of two grown children. Today, we'll be digging into the topic of creative free play. What does it mean, and why is it so important? Welcome, Astrid.
Thank you.
I'm glad to have you here. Today we're going to be talking about the importance of play, which is a really big topic, particularly for early childhood in Waldorf pedagogy. And you primarily work with children that are between the ages of 3 and 4, typically?
Yeah.
So first of all, maybe let's start off with the actual definition or your definition of play. What is play?
Well, I think people call all sorts of things play, like soccer play and, you know, play a video game or play a board game. And that's not the type of play I will be talking about. Mm-hmm. I am talking about creative free play that comes out of the essence of the child. So there is no agenda attached to it. There is no outcome that we might want to see or that we can calculate. It is just the creativity that flows out of young children's activity.
Mm-hmm. Why is it important that children have that space to play like that without boundaries? Or because it sounds to me like when you're talking about like games or any type of game, really, there's parameters on that, there's rules, mm-hmm. and whatnot, mm-hmm. and so you're speaking more of a very loose whatever
goes. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Yeah. So why is that important to have that?
Because young children's play, or, you know, for young children, I am speaking about not just the 3 and 4 year olds, it starts way earlier and it goes way into the elementary school years and beyond. I was thinking about it, mm-hmm. on my way over here when my childhood, how play played a very big role in my life. And the idea of creative free play is really allowing children to express or find ways to explore the world on their terms, without adults influencing or asking questions, but having the opportunity to engage with whatever material is available, whatever environment is there, be it inside, be it outside, you know, be it, I don't know, in the corner of a room or at a doctor's office. It's possible really anywhere, and that's the gift of creative free play. However, it's become harder and harder for children to engage in free play because we're just too busy to let it happen. And our society wants results for anything that children or humans do.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And you're, I'm maybe making an assumption, but free play and creative free play can take place as a solo activity. It can take place with one friend, with multiple friends.
Yeah. You just put more variables into the mix. And of course, young children, what I see in early childhood in the preschool, 2, 3, and sometimes 4 year olds, they just enjoy playing by themselves and they make up their own rules and you can hear them humming or singing or talking to themselves. And it's a very beautiful sound to hear. And then, you know, at some point they become more interested in other children as well. And that usually starts around 2, 2.5, 3 year olds. They want to have a buddy or a little friend. And then conversations start and social skills have to be learned. Children learn to negotiate, argument, you know, take turns, maybe take a step back and let something happen. And it can unfold all out of their own activity rather than being told by an adult of what should happen.
Mm-hmm. When do you know that you're witnessing healthy play?
When there's no whining. When there's that hum in the room that everyone seems to be busily engaged, and it doesn't have to be quiet, it can be, you know, rambunctious too, but it's that joy that you can hear in the children's voices. Sometimes it's a more a quiet hum, but there's definitely something that's very wholesome, and it feels very good for everyone that's participating in it. And I think the children, although not consciously, but recognize themselves as well, that was a good play we had today. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And for parents who would be listening and maybe trying to translate this into their home environment.
It's a good question.
Yeah. So how would you notice healthy or notice it, encourage it, you know, within the home? And obviously there may be siblings, there may not be siblings. So maybe mom or dad is being asked to participate. You want to talk about that a little?
Yeah. What I find that is very challenging for parents today is that we are told that we need to continually entertain our children. And it starts from the very, 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 very tiny one. It begins with the infants, really, when you have these, you know, now car seats with the iPad holder, because the baby, you know, might be bored. Babies are not bored. You know, think about yourself arriving in a different universe and everything is new and different and you have the opportunity to explore, but you're never really allowed to. You're always put into a place or a position and something's put in front of you and you're supposed to be doing whatever. And of course, young children are very smart and bright and they figure it out. But that type of entertaining really takes something away that is essentially childhood. And I see it all the time. Parents pick up their children from preschool and they go, oh, now we got to go to dance, or now mom has a project at home and we're going to craft this afternoon. And for me, I think the most beautiful thing for a child would be is to come home and have a lunch and a little quiet time and then just be able to play with whatever is at home. It seems simple when you hear it, and it is simple, but on the other hand, it can also be very, very huge for someone to step back and say, okay, I'm going to allow this to happen. I'm going to allow this to unfold without worrying that they're not going to learn anything or that they might get bored. So it's something that is necessary to change within the adults, within the parents.
Mm-hmm. I guess there's a lot of societal expectation educating, pre-educating.
Yeah.
And
Is always a purpose. There's always an agenda. My child can do this. My child can do that. And so there's a lot of pressure on young families for the children to perform and to know their colors and to know their numbers. And, you know, it's all...
It's a lot. Yeah.
It's a lot.
Why don't we sort of explore a little bit around toys, because that's something that certainly when raising, you know, young children, we have toys at home. There's an expectation that there may be toys in a preschool environment. Why don't we step back? Why don't you describe to me what the environment of a Waldorf preschool looks and feels like?
All right, I'm very good at this. When we have new families come into the school, they're always surprised how simple everything looks. And anyone who's ever done a project that looks very simple knows that it actually isn't, and that there's a lot of effort behind it to make it look simple. So the classrooms are... very warm and inviting. The walls are painted in a special way called lasurings. They're sort of peachy, orangey, pinkish, giving a sense of three-dimensional, so it's not a flat wall. And there is really nothing on the walls except for these beautiful designs that can be imagined into anything. It's quite gorgeous to see. And the furniture and the toys are all made of natural materials, because we want the children who are touching these materials to be touching something from nature that is not plastic, not something mechanical, but true to its essence. And there's baskets of rocks and pine cones and shells, and it really allows the 3- and 4-year-olds to walk into the classroom and create the world that they want to create. We have quite a few materials for gross motor activities. So there are some rocking horses in there. There's planks in there. Children will build slides with it. I have everyone's favorite, still is, after many, many years, these fence boards that the children had sanded down, and they're made into anything from raft to skis to a ski shop to a roof over a house. And these materials are all open-ended, which allows a child to have an idea and then recreate that idea in reality. Sometimes parents say, well, I can do that too. That's a simple thing to do, to just have rocks and shells and things in my home. And it is, and I recommend it. But also know that it takes some time for children to discover what these materials offer, because often they've been engaging with materials that have very limited activities. There's things that you can push that make noise. Many toys are noise-making toys these days. They're very specific from a movie or a Disney character, so they already have a positionality or personality that the child sort of tries to recreate. And with the toys in a Waldorf classroom, there is none of that, so everything has to be invented and really worked through and imagined by the children.
Mm-hmm. If you were going to give a parent maybe a little, like a short list of 3 or 5 things that might be great to bring into the home, you know, and maybe swap out for, I'm not asking you what to swap it out for, but, you know, if they're going to just have a little starter kit of Waldorf toys, what might you recommend?
Well, it depends on the age of the child, and it depends on who that child is. So I wouldn't know. Mm-hmm. However, there are certain toys and activities certain children enjoy at certain times in their lives. And if we speak about 3- and 4-year-olds, they love to help around the house. So having their own little broom and dustpan. I went to visit this family last year who I think the dad had built this contraption with all these different brushes and feather things, and it was sort of a cleaning thing that was on wheels and had a mop, and the little guy loved it. He would drag it around. Before I showed up, he had cleaned the whole house, mopped it all. And so activities that they can imitate that the adults do around them. Children also love a little workbench with a real hammer, real nails, real boards that they can work on, old-fashioned drills that are old hand drills. So, of course, it takes some supervision. And if there is a mom or a dad that are actively building things around the children, it's definitely for the child something very special to have their own toolkit. So mostly things that you find around a household in adult size, children at that age would love to have it at their own size. younger children like a rocking horse, like I described earlier. They like the more movement activities. And yeah, cloths for making houses. Children love that.
You're listening to ParentWise, a parent education podcast on child development through the Waldorf lens. I'm Kirsten Andrews. For more information, visit SquamishWaldorf.com. That's SQUAMISH Waldorf.com.
I've heard you speak about helping in the kitchen as
yes.
well in the past.
Yes. Children love to do that. And then we're impatient because they're not fast enough or they're not clean enough. And so we do it rush, rush, rush. And then by the time we really want them to help, they're done with it. And they're like, I'm not helping anymore. So there's really these points in children's lives that we can catch them and help them or allow them to participate. And they want to. And then it becomes a habit and they love to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So if you're going to make some soup, you might want to build in an extra 45 minutes.
Something like that.
Beforehand. To have
yeah.
the time
yeah.
to allow for them to
yes.
to go at their own pace.
Yeah.
Sure. We touched on it a little bit, but outdoor play, there's obviously a whole new world
mm-hmm.
outside.
Mm-hmm. Yes, outdoor play, especially now in the time of COVID, I think has taken on a new meaning. And as a almost a remedy for all the time, many children, and I know as adults, we try to limit their time on screens or on devices, but to really balance it out is time in nature. And it's much better to go outside with children than turning on a screen for them. Outside play offers lots of different possibilities because you often don't bring toys out or you don't have a set of toys out there. They're already there. There are logs and old stumps, and if you're lucky, there is, you know, some mud and a creek. And it allows children to engage with the natural world and explore what this world is like, but also come to recognize, what am I capable of? Can I climb this log? Can I reach the top of this old tree stump? What can I do to do that? And so this ability to gauge one's own abilities and skills really, really allows the outdoor play to unfold. And when there is more than one child to do that, there's this really great opportunity for social interactions. At school, when we're outside, we never ever have any, you know, discipline or guidance issues because there's just so much space and children are just so much in their element when they're outside, which changes when we go inside. So we do spend a lot of time outside specifically because of that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. A lot of parents, especially I would say, not new parents, but parents of a first child, tend to have a natural concern or response to, like, is what my child engaging in, is it safe? Are they going to get hurt? Are they going to fall off of that stump? But, you know, like, how much do I let them do? How do
yeah.
you advise those parents?
Well, I always say, you know, if your child falls off the stump, that's a good thing. Maybe he'll climb up again, and maybe he'll fall off again, and maybe by the fourth time he's figured out not to fall off. But a little bit of injury is always better than always protecting and a child never learning their own limits. And later on, when they're teenagers, they will test those limits even more. And there's been some studies done that children who are able to manage their own risks from early on will later on also be able to manage their risks much better than children who had never been allowed to manage their own risk. So a little bit of danger is always good, and you know, oh, you bumped your knee, we look after it, you know, you sit on my lap for a while and cry, and then they're off again and they're up there again trying it again. So children are very resilient in that way, and when they have the opportunity right from very, very young ages to try things out, they're less likely to injure themselves than children who've been overly protected.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I know that one thing that does come up a lot for parents who are introducing playmates or you know, having children playing together in that age group of 2, 3, 4, 5 even, is you'll have some small altercations sometimes, or you know, someone will hit somebody over the head with a toy, or somebody won't share. Those things,
yes,
obviously happen, and we all, you know, as parents deal with them in different ways, but perhaps there's a healthy way of addressing some of those issues, and I'm wondering if maybe you can speak to that.
Well, yes. I mean, children are so varied in their experiences and in expressing their needs. You have the really shy ones who might get run over, and you have the really boisterous ones who will just take over. And so for me, the importance is that each child feels safe, that there's nobody feeling, you know, they're afraid of something or somebody. If that happens, that certainly needs to be addressed. And children need the opportunity to learn being in a social situation from very young age. And this is what's a little bit changed with COVID too. Children don't have that opportunity when they're 2 and 3 and 4 to be with each other, to, you know, to learn to take a turn or to learn to hold on to this shovel because I had the shovel first and, you know, I'm not done yet. Those opportunities are not there unless they have a sibling, an older or a younger sibling. And so I see that too, that there is a change where I think it's the importance of being with each other is sometimes, you know, overlooked in that way. And we are certainly dealing with that in our classrooms right now. Mm-hmm. Children, they really want to be with each other, but they have very, very few skills being with each other, and it's mm-hmm. we're learning skills that maybe, you know, 2-year-olds learn or 3-year-olds learn, very mm. young ones.
It's really interesting.
It is. Yeah. It's fascinating. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And how do you demonstrate discipline or guide children in that way? What? Yeah. Parents. This is like the question that everyone wants.
Yeah.
To...
I had a little girl today. There was 2 of them playing in the little sandbox inside, and one of them had a shell, and she was making a little cake, and the shell was right beside her little heap of sand, and as she was reaching for it, somebody else snatched it away. And I didn't see this, but she came to me, the little girl came to me and said, "Oh, this little boy in the purple shirt took the shell away." And I said, "Oh, maybe he didn't even know you were still playing with it. Let's go back and tell him that you were playing with this shell and you weren't done yet." And she didn't want to say anything, so I said, "I'll speak for you." And I said, "Little
Johnny."
"Little Johnny." I don't want to say any names. You know, Rosie wasn't done yet with that shell, and she would like it back. And I said to Rosie, I nudged and I said, "Hold out your hand, and so he can see that he can put the shell into your hand." And he did. He just hadn't paid attention to it. So I think very often we're overreacting or overthinking the situation, and children just need an example or someone saying, "Oh, this is how you can deal with that situation, and I can do it with you, and we can practice it together," and it happens. So they are quite capable, and they're quite wanting to learn to be with each other too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for that example. I think that's I mean, honestly, as you know, as a parent, I think we experience a lot of fear sometimes about, like, oh my goodness, what is my child going to grow up to be like if this is the sort of impulse that, you know, is coming out of them at that age, and it's difficult to not catastrophize,
step in and
think that there's something a lot bigger going on.
I think it's better to step back than to step in, and unless, of course, someone's being hurt, but otherwise, just step back and observe the situation, and then, you know, support what needs to be supported.
What hinders children from engaging in play?
Well, the biggest hindrance that we've experienced over the past decades is the increase in media. And when I started teaching at the Waldorf School, all we had was television that we recommend that children would not be allowed to watch movies because it really interferes with healthy development. And when we look at research that was done in the States and in Europe, children today are much more prone to challenges in, you know, having sleeping disorders, eating disorders, anxiety. And I think a big part of that is their exposure to media content that's not appropriate, or even just sitting in front of a screen really takes away from the opportunities of movement, of engaging in other things. And so we have found a real decline in the ability to play the way I described it in our children when they come to the school, because they look at the toys and they're like, what am I going to do with this now? And it takes some time for them to really grow into that type of play and leave that screen influence behind them. I think one thing that I usually tell parents is to remember that whatever we see is never erased out of our souls. So whatever image we see on a screen will always live within us. And for young children, it's really important that the images are not on a screen, that they're of real life, and that they're beautiful, and that they're good, and that they're true. So that's the biggest hindrance, I think, is media. Also, toys, the amount of toys children have. I mean, we know that there's this overwhelming
glut of
amount
things,
of things coming at them.
Clothing,
and,
too.
More and more. I think you did your Kim Jong-un simplicity parenting that you can half the toys and then half them again, and I think you can still take another half, and that will be enough in children's bedrooms. So the amount of things that we have is too much for our children. Nobody can love 30 stuffies. You know, you can give your love to one or two, but 30 is just too many, and that's what a lot of children are suffering from too, as well, is that amount.
Yeah, one of the key things that really stuck out in my mind was, worrying that you're going to take away something beloved, or not be able to discern what's important and what's not important, and suddenly you'll have removed something that is going to be badly missed. And one of the things that was suggested, which I found very helpful in my children when they were younger, is to put the things away, maybe move them into the shed or the garage or what have you, in a bin. And, you know, if in 1 month to 3 months, if it hasn't been asked for, they're not missing it, you know. And you can do a number of things, and you can just donate those things and have them out of your space, or you can rotate, you know, and have a bit of a toy library where parents can, you know, take things in and out of play, in and out of circulation. I really like that one. How do you see play change as children grow?
Well, we touched upon it a little bit. They're very, very young. Really right from the very beginning, you know, the first thing a child discovers when they're 3 or 4 months old is their own hands, and that's really the best toy for them at that age. And they don't need as much as we think they need. Some very simple toys for the very young are really all they need. Some blocks, maybe a ball, a rocking horse, a little wagon that they can fill things into and pull around. Rudolf Steiner said the first toy should always be a doll, a soft doll that a child has, that representative of the human beside themselves to, you know, bring to bed or bring along wherever they go. So very, very simple. And then we talk when they're a little bit older, things that happen around them in the house, a little dustpan, a broom, you know, a cloth to help with, an apron. I remember my daughters, they loved it when they got their gardening gloves, the little butterflies on them, just things that maybe seem to us not really worthy, but to them it's a very special thing when they can participate and, you know, put on that apron, put on those boots and be just like mom or dad. And then they grow a bit older and they start wanting to pretend. So a little kitchen in the corner where they can pretend play, make tea for their dollies, have a little bed for their dollies, cloths and maybe larger blocks and planks to build a car, to go for a ride, things like that that they experience in the world and then they take into the play. And when they're around 3 and 4, they're really at their most creative in their lives. This is where we as adults draw from that creativity that we were allowed to explore at that age. We will never be as creative anymore, and so this time is very, very special for that, and it needs to be treasured and cherished and looked after so that can really unfold in children at that age. And then, you know, at 4, 5, the social play really starts to happen. They really want to hang out with friends or meet their friends and invite their friends to the play. And so the play changes again. It becomes very much, oh, you do this and I'll be the mom and she'll be the baby. And there's more discussion on what is going to happen in the play or what's going to unfold. And then sometimes the 6 and 7 year olds, they just talk about what they're going to play and they never actually really play. And I remember my daughter having a friend over. She was in grade 1 and they climbed the tree outside the house and they were in that tree for the whole afternoon discussing what they're going to do. And then my daughter's friend's mom came to pick up her girl and the girl said, but we didn't play yet. And they had just been talking about what they were going to do all day. So that can happen too in the kindergarten with the older ones, that this planning and we're going to do this and then this is going to happen really takes over the play. Games like, so the social games start enter the play where there is rules, where children love following the rules at that point, 7, 8, and then it goes from there. I think organized games then later on really take big importance in children's lives. Yeah.
Is there anything else that parents and caregivers can do to support play?
Well, children need a relaxed and rhythmic life, home life, to find the time to play. Mm-hmm. If we're never home, we're not going to be able to play. If we're always rushing from one place to the other, children can never find the time to play. So really put time aside and not think, oh, you know, it's going to be a long weekend. What are we going to do? Fill it with activities. Just think that maybe this weekend we're just going to stay home and allow for that to unfold and happen. Children love it when the adults are close by. So don't have a playroom upstairs when you're working in the kitchen. Make sure the playroom, or even set up a little play area close to where the children can see you and you can see them. And sometimes they want to invite you and say, oh, Mom, can you come for tea? And yes, of course you come for tea, and you have tea. And then you say, oh, and now Mom has to go back to work, and I'll finish dinner, or I'll finish whatever I need to do. And so children get a little bit of this one-on-one, and then they can let it go again, and Mom can go back and do the things that she needs to do. The environment needs to be inviting. We talked a little bit about this, that too many toys can be too overwhelming. So the toys really should have each their own place where they live, not just big boxes with things in them that are all mixed up and nobody knows where something is. Less is more is a big one. And like you said, you can trade them out. If you see there's some toys that are never played with, well, then put them away for a while and put something else there. And children love big cloths and blankets to build houses and caves. So those are all things that are conducive to play. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And a couch that has cushions that come off.
Oh, yeah. You can jump on. And don't interrupt them. I think very often we want to comment on what they're doing, and we want to kind of support what they're doing. And so we say things like, oh, how many cushions did you use over there? Or what else could you do with this? Or, oh, good job, you've done this or that. We don't need to comment on the children's play. They're better off if we hold back and just observe and not ask too many questions. Yeah.
Is there anything else that that we didn't touch on that you wanted to mention?
I think I did say in the beginning we always have sort of expectations of some sort of outcome when children are engaging in play. And I think many of the things that happen with children when they are playing creatively are actually unfolding, be it language when they're with their friends, being it a focus and concentration or determination. Those are all sort of skills that are maybe not quite seen or not visible, but those are all things that children learn when they are engaged in free play. Things like determination are all these skills you need for reading and writing later on, you know, left, right, up, down, those experiences in space. And one of the biggest things for me, I think, is the joy that children have when they're engaged in play, and that laughter that you can hear.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you so much. I think that your experience with such a variety of children is really beneficial for parents listening, because we only know our child or our children and you know the way that they interact and play, but it's such a an expansive way to approach it when, you know, speaking to somebody who's cared for hundreds of children over the years. And seeing those children grow up, you know, to be really healthy and vibrant individuals, and knowing that, you know, you've had a hand in that, but also so much of what you do for your classes, and also, you know, you taught my children when they were 2.5 to 4.5, 5 years old, the imparting of your wisdom. You know, it is parent education, but it's more than that. And to be able to learn from you has been such a pleasure and an honor, and I feel that parents are very fortunate when they have someone such as yourself to be able to help guide them through some of these things, because you've seen so many scenarios and you know, been able to respond to them, and we just have our own little small bubble, you know, that we're so invested in. So it's nice to have that outside perspective.
Yeah, I certainly find that parents are being a parent is such an important task, and we're giving it all, and we're always so hard on ourselves. Oh, we should have done this better or that better. And I think we also need to remember to be kind to ourselves, and, you know, pick one thing that we might want to change and then work on that a little bit, rather than, oh, now I know what to do and I'm going to do it all. Well, that's probably not going to work. So,
mm-hmm.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
One day at a time.
Thanks, Astrid.
Oh, thank
you,
Kirsten.
It was a pleasure.
Yeah.
Thanks for listening to ParentWise. We created this podcast for parents and caregivers interested in learning more about healthy child development through the Waldorf lens. If you have questions about anything you heard in today's podcast, we invite you to reach out to us. Our email is parentwise@squamishwaldorf.com. You can also find us on Instagram and Facebook. If you think you know someone who might enjoy our content, be sure to send them a link. You can also visit us at squamishwaldorf.com.